Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Ram Whitaker. He was born in New York City and came to India when he was 7. He's an herpetologist with hundreds of publications and co-founder of the Madras State Park, Andaman and Nicobar Environment Trust, and the Madras Crocodile Bank Trust. In 1984, Whitaker won a Rolex Award for Enterprise for starting a snake venom cooperative for Irula tribals, and again in 2008 for his efforts to create a network of rainforest research stations throughout India. In 2005, he was the winner of a Whitley Award to found the Agumbe Rainforest Research Station in Karnataka for the study of king cobras and their habitat. To spread his message, Whitaker has made 30 documentaries for channels such as National Geographic, BBC, and Animal Planet, and a children's feature film. For his work in wildlife conservation, he received the Government of India's Padma Shri Award in 2018. So first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek, for giving me this opportunity to spout a little bit. I would like to start out by telling you about my obsession with king cobras, which started when I was pretty young. During my school years in South India, I had the luck of going to school at a place basically surrounded by forest, and I was already into snakes, in fact, from the time I was really young, and I always wanted to find and see a king cobra. Unfortunately, I never did see one in my school years, and it was only when I came to the United States and I got a job at the Miami Serpentarium and got my first close-up look at king cobras, where my boss and my guru, really, William Haast, was extracting venom from king cobras for research and for production of antivenom. So that was really my first glimpse of king cobras, but not in the wild, of course. So when I came back to India after that, I set up something called the Madras Snake Park, and it was India's first reptile park. And in the first year we started, we had 1 million visitors, which was quite amazing to me. I mean, I realized people were scared of snakes, but they're obviously very interested in them also. And it just seemed to me that everyone should get to see a king cobra. So I still continued my searches for king cobras in India's Western Ghats and the South Indian forests on the western coast. And I lucked out by being told that a place called Agumbe is where I should go. Well, I went to Agumbe, and within the first 24 hours, I found my first 2 king cobras. And that in itself is a story because, I was experienced with handling snakes, but not sort of the 12 and 14 foot long ones that king cobras are. So I'll just briefly tell you how I encountered my first one. I saw this black tail disappearing into the bushes, and I really thought it was a rat snake because this non-venomous snake in that area is black. So I dove on it in typical snake hunter fashion, grabbed the tail, and then looked up, and this thing was towering over me with its hood spread. I had caught a king cobra by the tail. Well, my instant reaction, of course, was let it go. I mean, survival came first. And then I said, wait a minute, I've just let go of my first king cobra. Luckily, it went into some bushes, and I grabbed a stick nearby and pulled it out, grabbed it by the tail, and over the next 10 or 15 minutes, sort of tired it out, and I got a bit tired too, trying to make sure that it wouldn't bite me, but at the same time trying to get my sleeping bag, which is literally the only bag big enough that I had with me, out of my knapsack hanging on my back. I know this sounds complicated, and it's kind of hard to describe how I did it, but I managed to get the sleeping bag out, still holding the snake by the tail, and stretched the sleeping bag out, made it open at one side so that the king cobra would see that it's a safe retreat. I mean, a nice dark cave is what I thought. And, well, luckily enough, it worked, and the snake went inside, so I had bagged my first king cobra. Well, this was just the beginning of it, because I brought it to the snake park, and I had found another one, so now I had a pair of king cobras, and thousands, tens of thousands of people were coming to see them, and of course it was very exciting for them to see them up close. But it wasn't till some years later, many years later, in fact, that I got more seriously involved in studying king cobras. The place, this town, this little village of Agumbe is actually quite incredible. It's the whole area gets the highest rainfall in South India we get as much as 30 feet of rain during the monsoon, which lasts from June to September. And this wetness has created this fantastic rainforest there with a myriad of all sorts of creatures typical of rainforests. But for me, the most spectacular thing, of course, is that king cobras could actually be called common there. Well, plus the fact that people worship snakes in India, in many parts of the country, cobras are revered and not killed because of this reverence. And the king cobra has a special place amongst people of the Agumbe area. And this, you know, to try to conserve snakes, to get people to stop killing snakes is pretty difficult, but here was a tremendous advantage. They already had a religious reverence for the snake. So it was the ideal place for me to start doing research. And that's when I had the idea of setting up this research station, and actually bought a little piece of land surrounded by rainforest and set up a little research station there. And then with the help from the grant from the Whitley Fund for Nature, I was actually able to make it into a real substantial research station. And of course, my first order of business was to start studying king cobras. So I enlisted the help of a rattlesnake expert from Arizona by the name of Matt Good at the University of Arizona. He has implanted radios in literally thousands of rattlesnakes and studied them for years and years, decades really. And this is the kind of person I needed to help me figure this out, how to radio track king cobras. And that's when it all started. So we've put radios into about 9 king cobras there and studied them for years and years now. I think we're in our 11th year of studying king cobras. And I think the most amazing thing is here's a snake that moves miles and miles even in one day, if you can imagine that, and has a home range of up to 20 square miles. And it just amazed us, because snakes are, well, you know, they do move pretty fast, but they don't usually have a huge range. But here you're talking about a big predator, actually. And interestingly enough, the average home range for a king cobra seems to be very similar to the home range of an adult leopard, another apex predator in a forest area. So we were not only finding out the basics of their home ranges and what they do, we were finding out much more complicated stuff about their behavior. For example, the king cobra, out of the 3,000 odd species of snakes in the world, the female king cobra is the only snake that makes a nest. And it's an amazing feat, actually, for a limbless animal. She actually gathers leaves up over a period of a week or two and makes a pile of leaves 3 or 4 feet high and up to 6 or 8 feet in diameter, and then goes inside and lays her 20 to 30 or even sometimes 40 eggs inside this incubation chamber that she makes so beautifully. And then the heavy rains hit. She starts making her nest just before the rains, and then this 20 or 30 feet of rain sort of deluges the place. But the eggs stay absolutely dry, very humid, of course, from the humidity inside, but absolutely dry from actual rainfall. And they incubate inside the nest over a period of 60 to 80 days, depending on the temperature. If it's warmer, of course, they develop faster. And then the babies hatch out. The female usually deserts the nest, and I think it makes a lot of sense, because king cobras are snake eaters, and it would be pretty risky if the king cobra female, having sat on the nest for a couple of months already and without feeding, gets pretty hungry and sees all these little snakes, crawling around. It could be too tempting for her. So she usually pushes off, and then the babies hatch and then disperse on their own. This is a very vulnerable time for any baby animal, and baby snakes in particular have lots and lots of predators. So once I was very lucky to come upon a king cobra nest in the wild in the Andaman Islands and actually saw the babies emerging from the nest. It was just pure luck that I got there at this time. But every single one of them went straight up into the bamboo and bushes and climbed up away from the ground. And this, to me, made a lot of sense. There's so many of the predators like wild pigs and mongooses and civet cats and other predators on the ground wouldn't be able to find these little guys up in the trees and in the bushes. So this study that we're continuing to do is also very much a part of education for the local people. I mean, I did say originally that people are, you know, quite reverent toward king cobras, but they're also pretty scared of them. And our education program is actually linked to something we call a snake rescue program, because king cobras have a tendency to come into people's houses, into their pump houses, and into their cow sheds, basically searching for snakes to eat. The fact is, rats are very commonly found in people's houses and in huts in village India. And this is where rat snakes and cobras usually enter into their houses to eat the rats. And the king cobra, with its fantastic sense of smell, is following these snake trails and following them right into people's houses. So there's a young guy working for us there by the name of Ajay Giri, and he is a really expert snake handler. He's the kind of easygoing guy that he just catches a king cobra by the tail and bags it with just such ease and so quick that people just are amazed that someone can be so calm and cool with such a huge, dangerous snake. What's really great is that every time a snake rescue happens, every time we get a phone call and Ajay has to rush off on his motorbike, or now lately he's got a Jeep, so he's in good shape, he gets to the house or to the garden where this king cobra is hanging around, and after carefully catching it and bagging it, usually there's a gang of people. We've had as many as 300 people show up for one of these king cobra rescues, and they're all excited, and you know, they've witnessed something they've never seen before. But he uses this opportunity to talk about king cobras and tell them, look, king cobras do not, they very, very rarely bite anybody. For one thing, they're big and conspicuous. You can see them. They're not one of these tiny snakes hiding in the bushes. They're also mostly diurnal. They're mostly active in the daytime, so there's not this risk of stepping on them at night. And a third factor is that they feed on all the snakes that really cause most of the snake bite accidents in India, the cobras and vipers and crates. So they are actually a very valuable animal to have around. I mean, I'd go to as far as to say, shucks, everyone should have a king cobra in their backyard. Well, I don't know how well that would be accepted, but it's a marvelous thing that people are so cool about it, and especially after these little educational stints that Ajay does, people are much, they'll call up and now they'll say, well, there's a king cobra in the garden, but I won't call you until if it enters the house. So people are actually getting quite cool about having king cobras around. And this is really a marvelous thing, a marvelous change from what it used to be.
So I have a few questions. A very trivial question is, how does it gather leaves without limbs? And then a bigger question is, can you talk about the sort of evolutionary history of them and their role? You said that they primarily eat snakes, and mm-hmm. one of the questions I was going to ask was, like wolves, when they are present, they help the natural community by forcing ruminants out of the easy places. So they will help the entire natural community. And I'm wondering, what are the king cobra's sort of role in the larger natural community? So teeny question, how do they work the leaves? And bigger question, what's their evolutionary history and role really?
Okay, the first question is very easy to answer. Okay, to watch a king cobra female make her nest is quite amazing. We've had the fortune of being there just at the right time and seeing her start to gather these leaves together. And she'll actually make a coil around a bunch of leaves and literally carry them up to the point where she's decided to make her nest. The nest site is usually on a slope, which makes a lot of sense because of a high rainfall area. You don't want it in a place which will get soggy. And what's very frustrating is to watch her carrying a bunch of leaves in her coil and then meeting a sapling on the way. And of course, the leaves all fall off and she just keeps going on thinking that she's still got them. And you're just dying to get over there and help her and, you know, throw a few handfuls of leaves onto the pile for her. But she's very patient and very persistent. And that's the only thing I can say that, that, you know, proves that she's able to make this pile of leaves over a period of quite a few days. I've seen it. We've seen them as much as 13 or 14 days still working on piling up the leaves. And she didn't just stop there. She's got this pile of leaves, which are rather loosely piled at first, but she'll crawl over them back and forth until it's packed down. So it's a real solid waterproof chamber, incubation chamber. Your second question, your second point, is a little more difficult to figure out because we don't know enough about king cobras yet to come to those answers as far as their sort of evolutionary history and their feeding habits and so on go. The species is called, the Latin name for king cobra is Ophiophagus. Ophiophagus means snake eater. And what's quite amazing is that they virtually only eat snakes, with one exception. They'll also eat monitor lizards. Now, in the evolutionary sense, that almost proves to me that monitor lizards are, you know, perhaps the forerunners of snakes, really, because snakes did evolve from lizards. They lost lizards which lost their legs. And things like monitor lizards have forked tongues. They have a Jacobson's organ in the roof of the mouth the way snakes do to interpret whatever they pick up on their tongues. And the king cobra, by eating monitor lizards, is kind of telling us that, evolutionarily speaking, monitors are snakes with legs. I mean, I'm putting it very simply here, but I'm not sure which direction exactly to go with your question. Would you elucidate a little bit on what kind of answer you might want out of what you said earlier?
Well, two things. One is, honestly, you can go any direction you want with it, whatever is most interesting to you. But if I were to suggest a direction, it's, so maybe this is one way to ask, is when, like I said, when wolves are removed from a natural community, a lot of times that can actually hurt the streams because the ruminants are no longer chased away from the riparian zones. So, or if prairie dogs disappear, everybody eats prairie dogs, and so you'll have this cascading effect of them not being there, and prairie dogs are a central food system for the prairies. Or salmon. Would salmon disappear in a region, or when salmon are taken out of a region, forests will lose a lot of nutrients. So I'm just, so one of the questions would be, if cobras, so one way we could look at what do they do is if there were cobras in a place and then the cobras are, the king cobras are eradicated, what does that do? What are the cascading effects? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And actually, it's sort of a perplexing thing because I'm also working with king cobras in an oil palm plantation in Kalimantan. And the reason that this project started there is because the people there at this particular oil palm plantation don't want to use rodenticides, and they want a very natural ecosystem for example, they're very oil palms are very affected by rodents, and most oil palm plantations do use rodenticides, but they'd much prefer using the natural predators. So we started doing this study on king cobras and finding out that one of the main prey is are the Sumatran cobras, the spitting cobras that are found there, which are rodent eaters. So my first impression was, hey, if we're, you know, sort of encouraging king cobras, and king cobras are becoming very common, they're finishing off the rodent predators. Now, is that not bad? But when we discussed this a little further, and again, Matt Good from the University of Arizona was with me there, we discussed this a little further and said, now, wait a minute, this is an overall, we must take an overview. A predator in an ecosystem is a very essential part of the ecosystem, and it's not as though he's going to finish off the cobras. In fact, he may be finishing off the cobras which should be finished off, the weaker, slower ones, and thus raising the genetic quality of the remaining snakes that are there. In the case of Agumbe, going back to where our main study is, they are, as I mentioned, feeding on a lot of the other species of snakes that are found there, and in particular, some of them specialize in feeding on the common cobras, which, as I mentioned, do cause significant number of snake bites, including snake bite deaths in India. And they feed on, as well as they feed on rat snakes, which is another large snake found in rice fields. And again, they're found in the rice fields because of their rodent-eating behavior. So it is one thing about the fact that we keep arguing and telling the people that king cobras are great because they control the numbers of some of these very dangerous venomous snakes. That's great from the people's standpoint, but our study should include and does, at least we are aware of the fact that they're eating the rodent-eating snakes as well. So wouldn't this have a tendency to increase the number of rodents, destroying more grain, for example? So it's pretty complicated, and I think we're probably just at the beginning of our study, really, even though we've been at it for over a decade.
So another question about the king cobras. You said that they have a large range, and do they have territories where will they be the primary snake in that territory, the primary king cobra in that snake, or do their territories overlap greatly? And how do the babies find a new territory? Do they have to basically go out and just hope that even their parents don't eat them?
Yes, that's really interesting, because they do have particular territories, but they do overlap a lot. And during the breeding season, it's especially obvious, because from about February onwards, when a male king cobra meets another male king cobra, chances are it'll end up in a male combat. And a male combat in snakes is very well documented in many species around the world, including rattlesnakes in America. And it's a really marvelous thing to watch, because the snakes twine around each other, they raise up, and basically they seem to be doing a wrestling match trying to push the other one down. There's very rarely any biting or any very serious injury involved in this type of thing, and people call it ritual combat, they call it combat dance, and it is literally like a dance. And this can sometimes go on for more than an hour, and the snakes obviously get pretty tired out. But one evidently does beat the other one, in other words, sends him off and pushes him off from the area where he's established his territory. And his territory is not just an area that he's defending. He's also almost always defending a female. And this is now emerging, and we're finding out more and more about it as we go along. But it does seem as though the male and female will pair up as much as a month or two prior to the mating season, which is usually in April, just a month before the female starts making her nest in May. And the male king cobra is literally defending this female. But the point that you made at the end there is also extremely significant, because they do eat each other. They are cannibalistic. And we've seen several cases of the male king cobra eating a female king cobra, but usually after the breeding season, not during the breeding season. But the female, even at the time of courtship, just prior to mating, she has a particular display where she'll not raise the hood, but she'll spread the hood very widely and exhibit her very strongly marked bands on the back of her neck, so that the male king cobra recognizes her as what she is and not as a prey item. This is, of course, a little bit of guesswork, but it seems to work. It seems that they then will mate.
So before the interview, we had talked about whether we were going to just talk about King Cobras or other subjects too, and we're about halfway through. And would you like to switch over to snake bites, or would you like to talk about gharials, or what would you like to do now?
Well, let's talk about gharial, and like as you suggested, maybe we can do a separate one for snake bite, because that's kind of my current I could say obsession. But yeah, but gharial are incredibly interesting animals. So does that sound good to you?
That sounds great. And I for whatever reason, I have my first memory of knowing anything about gharials was when I was a little child. We got a picture book of various animals, and I was struck by it even as a child, and I don't know a lot about them, but I've always loved them since I was probably six. So I would be delighted to hear, as much as you can tell everybody, probably most of the listeners have never heard the word before. Any way you can help people to fall in love with them would be fantastic.
Okay. I think all you got to do is see a picture of a young one, especially to fall in love with a gharial. But let me start from the beginning. The word gharial comes from a Hindi word, ghara, G-H-A-R-A, which means mud pot. And the gharial is called this because when a male reaches adulthood, he grows a very interesting projection on the front of his snout. And that's the thing that they call the ghara in Hindi. And this actually covers the nostrils and amplifies his hissing to a sort of flatulent brrrr sound, which carries across the river and tells the other male large gharial that, look, I'm the big boss around here. So they communicate this way. But I think the most spectacular thing about the gharial is that it's the crocodile with the most slender of all snouts of any crocodilian, and it's very, very specifically adapted for catching fish. If you look at the beak or the snout of a gharial, the jaws of a gharial, they resemble, in America, the garfish, which is pretty common in the south, or looking at a dolphin snout, a bottlenose dolphin, which has a nice long snout with this row of teeth. And again, all adapted specifically for catching fish. This plus the fact that their fish eating habits, plus the fact that gharial are really wedded to rivers, river systems. They're not typically found in lake areas or swampy areas, but in clear, fast-flowing rivers, is actually a tremendous disadvantage for the species, because rivers are fast disappearing, I mean, at least pristine rivers. So in 1973, the World Wildlife Fund in India had just started a couple of years prior to that, and I applied for a grant. In those days, a 3,000 rupee grant would probably have converted to a couple of hundred dollars, but it didn't seem like a magnanimous amount, but it was perfect for me to go up north to where the gharial are found and to go to some of those rivers and try to count how many were left, because we had some fears that they were disappearing. And there were some reports that they're hardly ever seen in their haunts where they used to find them. So I did this survey for several months, and we came up with a figure that there are probably only about 150 or 160 gharial left in the wild. This means that this creature, this wonderful animal, was on the verge of extinction. Gharial are pretty big animals. An adult male can grow as long as 16 or even 20 feet, which, you know, makes it one of the largest species of crocodilians in the world, rivaling the saltwater crocodile, which is famous for its huge size. But being a fish eater, it does not trouble humans. It does not trouble livestock the way other crocodiles do. So here you've got this massive crocodilian, which is literally harmless to humans. Just a small exception to that is that when a female gharial makes a nest, like almost all other crocodilians, she'll be very defensive of that nest. And if you approach her nest, you could be in trouble, because they'll come out and defend it, and they do have sharp teeth. But they're not going to eat you. They're just going to bite you and chase you away. So having found out that Garya were on the verge of extinction, what to do? What's the next step? Well, we certainly publicized this very widely, and the government of India at that time was under the stewardship of the then Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi, who was very wildlife-centric and very, very positive about needing to make conservation high on her priorities. They started something called Project Crocodile, and they actually we and they started collecting eggs from the wild from the last few animals that were nesting and started incubating them in captivity. And you can get a very high hatching rate, almost 100% if you incubate them well, and then rearing the babies up to about 3 feet long, 3 or 4 feet long, and then restocking, releasing them back in the wild. Now, it wasn't just that simple, because the wild places where they're being released also had to be protected. I mean, the habitat protection was incredibly important. And even today, some of our major rivers, the famous Ganges River and the Yamuna River, which flows past the Taj Mahal, are filthy, and they've really turned into sewers with all the waste water going into them, chemical waste as well as other kinds of waste. So, there's one river, however, which is still which is still pristine, and it's called the Chambal River. And for the last 10 years, well, now it's 12 years, we've been doing a study on the Garya there using radio telemetry, the same that we're doing with the king cobras, except in the case of the king cobra, we had to insert these tiny radios inside the king cobra, and then so the range isn't very long in terms of being able to pick up the signal, whereas with the Garya, the radio is actually put on the outside of the animal, so we can actually put so-called GPS radios on them and get the signal. The signal goes all the way up to a satellite and is bounced back to our receiver. So we can literally follow these Garya even if they travel, and they have traveled over 100 miles up and down the river. And this in itself was very fascinating, because we knew a little bit about them by starting to breed them in captivity at the Madras Crocodile Bank. And but to learn about their habits in the wild was really what was needed. And this study on the Chambal River is being undertaken by our partner by the name of Dr. Jeff Lang. And Jeff Lang is one of the world's top croc biologists, and we're really fortunate to have had him working here for so many years. And the stuff that we're finding out about the Garya is extremely important for the wildlife managers to formulate proper protection and management plans for the species. And I'm very happy to say that even though there are only perhaps less than 200 Garya back in the early 70s, you can count several thousand Garya on just the Chambal River alone. Maybe it's in bad shape in most of the other habitats where it used to be found, but the Chambal River is really good, it's in really good shape. And I think the big worry now is that since the Chambal River flows through some of the driest sections of India, the demands for fresh water, of course, are only increasing year after year. And there's a lot of dams being planned and diversions. And this could seriously affect not only the Garya, but the river dolphin, which is also a critically endangered species under the IUCN Red Data Book, and several very, very interesting species of turtles, which are also critically endangered. So, yeah, there are still problems, although, a lot of headway has been made, and we're still finding out a lot of wonderful facts about this creature.
Okay, so I have a few more questions about them.
Sure.
One is, are they generally solitary creatures, or will you often see, if you have a bunch of them, will a bunch of them hang out together? And then another mm-hmm. question would be, if they weigh 160 kilograms on average when they're adults, like, I don't really know much about reptiles eating. Do they, like, how many pounds of fish, I mean, since they eat fish, do they eat a few small fish every day, or one big fish every 2 weeks, or how does all that work?
Well, in fact, you've almost answered it right there. A few small fish a day or a big fish every couple of weeks. No, actually, it's the metabolic rate of a crocodilian is so low and so slow that they can really get along very well with eating very little. Their activity patterns sort of peak during the breeding season, but the rest of the time, they are, I'm not going to use the word lazy. They just sort of know how to live. They bask out in the sun. And yes, they are very social. A typical group of gharial, there'll be one male and one big adult male who may be 14 or 15 feet long, and there would be as many as 15 or 20 females in his, well, we could say, use the word harem in this case, because he keeps an eye on them and protects them. And if another male comes nearby, there could be a serious fight where he'll actually drive them away. So they're social up to that degree. Young gharial, of course, will be together. And what's a marvelous sight is to see shortly after the hatching time, groups of as many as 500 or 600 babies will be together in what's referred to by the croc biologist as a creche. And this creche is usually protected by the dominant male there. He'll chase everyone away, and he'll even chase some of the mother gharial away, just because he's looking after the babies so well. And if any predator comes near, he'll go after them as well.
And so what are the there's an echo. Okay, it's gone. Good. So the threats to them are primarily the pollution of the rivers and also dams turning them into basically reservoirs. Are there other major threats to them?
Right now, no. In the early days when we went there on our surveys, we found that people were they were hunting them for the skins. People were collecting the eggs to eat. People were killing them for so-called medicinal purposes. And all that stopped with the very, very strong action by the state forest departments. And something called the Indian Wildlife Protection Act came out in the mid-70s, which actually put a halt to all that. So it is now primarily the damming and the pollution of the rivers which could continue to cause problems for gharial. Things are definitely a lot better than they were then, but there's still problems, and still we've got to keep our eyes open and keep doing something, keep talking about it, basically.
So I'm thinking about dams, and I'm thinking about so traditionally, since you said they don't go to swamps, traditionally would the way, if they got eradicated from some place and then they were going to re-inhabit it, would they go only up and down the river? Or I know beavers, for example, it's kind of weird, but sometimes they can cross land even though they live in streams. So could they go overland to re-inhabit? Or basically, if they get down to a dam, is that an impassable barrier to them re-inhabiting on their own?
That's a really good question, because I can give you a practical example of what goes on. Well, in the case of the mugger crocodile, for example, the freshwater crocodile in India, it's one of these animals that does migrate overland, sometimes as much as 5 or 10 miles to get from one body of water to another if there's a serious drought, for example. A gharial is not able to walk over land like that. It can't raise itself up. It's a rather ungainly traveler on land. It's very, very aquatic, adapted creature. But something very interesting happened. One of the very first surveys we did was in a place called Corbett National Park, named after the famous tiger hunter called Jim Corbett, who wrote some fantastic books about tiger hunting back in the 30s and 40s. And Corbett National Park had one of the last breeding populations of gharial when I did my surveys there in 1974. And, I was there the year that they put a dam on the main river there called the Ram Ganga River. And we thought, oh man, this is the last breeding population of gharial, and it's had it. Now they're damming it. They're going to produce a big reservoir. Well, just contrary to what I thought, the Gariel are actually doing okay there to some degree, even though it's a massive lake now. It's called the Kalagar Dam. And there are hundreds of Gariel there, and they are breeding. The difficulty is, however, in a dam like that, in a reservoir, the water levels change so drastically that when the Gariel lays her eggs, the female Gariel lays her eggs in, let's say, early summer, which is to us April, May, or even earlier, in March, when the babies hatch, the water has receded several miles from that nest site, and there's no way those babies can get to the water. So the only way that something like this can survive is if the Gariel has laid its eggs on an island or by with the help of one of the wildlife managers there. When they find the nests, they'll put a mark on it. They'll either translocate it to the edge of the river or translocate the babies once they hatch back down into the reservoir. So it's not as bad as we thought. It's not as though, okay, they've dammed the river, this is it, Gariel's going to go extinct. They can still survive, but probably with a little help.
And you mentioned before captive breeding. Is that a big deal with them?
It used to be at the beginning when there were hardly any Gariel left, we thought that this is probably the only way we're going to be able to do it, and either captive breed or collect the last few nests in the wild. And this is whole head starting program. We and the government, the various government projects, probably released a total of 7,000 or 8,000 baby Gariel into these various habitats, okay? And as you know, in the case of releasing animals, the mortality is going to be pretty high. Perhaps a very small percentage of them would survive. But since this has been happening, you know, for over 30 years now, the need for captive breeding and for restocking habitats is not so strong now, because there are natural populations breeding already. It's only when we found another river which maybe used to have Gariel, and there's a good chance that it can be well protected, that we would use captive bred or captive reared animals for restocking. And in a way, it's better to try to convince the wildlife authorities, say, hey, look, we've succeeded in bringing these populations back. Now concentrate on that habitat protection. Forget about head starting. Just keep the rivers intact.
Well, that seems to be just a wonderful example of the appropriate use of a captive breeding or rearing program. This is exactly what you want, is to only do it for a little while, and then the natural the natural communities are able to be self-sustaining.
Yep, exactly. Well, the captive breeding program that we have at the Crocodile Bank, which my son Nikhil looks after, is actually pretty good too, because there are zoos around the world who would love to get a few Gariel. And the permitting process is very complicated, with the CITES permit and the vet permit and this and that. But we've been able to do some wonderful zoo exchanges. We just got some Komodo dragons from the New York Bronx Zoo, for example, in exchange for some Gariel. So it works both ways.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I guess a couple questions. What can people do? Is there anything people can do who care either about king cobras or Gariel to actually improve their lives, improve the lives of those creatures and their larger communities?
Well, I would always say if there's a possibility of support, for example, the Madras Crocodile Bank, you can easily, anyone can go online and find the details about its website and so on. And we've got this project both for the Gariel conservation as well as for King Cobra conservation. And we always tie in research with conservation, because unless we know enough about them, we're not going to be able to do the right conservation. So support in any way, either in cash or in publicity, is wonderful and always welcome.
And I guess that should have been an ending question, but I want to go back to the Gariel for a second. And you said before
Sure.
that the population got extremely low. And what is the wild population now, total probably?
I would guess the total population is close to 3,000 Garyo. And that includes a lot of young ones, of course. The adult population is only in the hundreds, which is still, it's still considered a critically endangered species. So this year, as many as more than 2,000 babies hatched in the Chumbul. But as soon as they hatch, a literal tsunami sort of comes down the river with the monsoon. So a lot of the babies, I would probably say upwards of 90%+ of the babies are just going to get washed into unsuitable habitats and into the mouths of predators. So very few will actually survive. So, yeah.
So prior to the dams and prior to like 5,000 years ago, that would have been a pretty good way for the gharials to disperse, right? Wouldn't that have been a natural that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the river systems, the Ganges river system is actually vast and there are many, many rivers involved here. And gharial can, during the very high water season after the monsoon, of course, they get washed down. But the rest of the year, they're very easily able to swim upstream and colonize other tributaries of the main rivers, for example.
And so you said that there's 90% or more are washed away. Can you really quickly give the lifespan of a gharial from, like, how big are they when they're hatched, and at what point are they going to be a fairly good chance of living out their lives? Like, mm-hmm. do most of them die before they get to be a foot or 2 feet or whatever? Or just when do they get to be sexually mature?
Yeah, well, a gharial when it's born is just about, and that's the most vulnerable period, and that's when most of them die, when they're still very small, and they're just starting to feed, and they're just getting washed away or getting finished off by predators. Once they reach over 3 or 4 feet long, they're pretty solidly stable by that time. If they're healthy, they're going to survive. They don't become sexually mature until it's quite a few years later. An adult male will take he has to get up to about 14 or 15 years, and he has to grow that nice gara on the tip of his snout. And a female has to be at least 10 or 12 years old. And then they'll live as long as a human being, 80 years or more. So that's sort of a typical crocodilian age span.
And do they remain reproductive, fertile, until they die, or are they like humans that they go through some sort of?
That's really a good question. It's not too much known about it. My son Nikhil, who I mentioned before, is looking after a breeding group of gharial at the Croc Bank, and some of them are the females laying eggs when they're over 40 years old, and they're absolutely viable eggs. They're bigger nests now that they're bigger females, but they seem to go on laying, well into their advanced age.
Okay, so last question. Is there anything you've wanted to say about cobras or gharials that I haven't given you the opportunity?
There's so many things I could go on and on about both the gharial and the cobra. But I think I've covered most of the main points, and I welcome anybody who's listening to write to me, which is real easy, kingcobra@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ron Whitaker. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.